Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Douglas Rushkoff has spent years writing books and articles about how we live, on our media, our new media, our culture. One day, he started wondering if the kind of economy, the style of capitalism we follow today, is the only kind there might be. And the history books, he decided, say no, that we took a turn along the way and gave up old-time capitalism for something he calls corporatism. Rushkoff argues that may have cost us our souls, and now, he argues, may be the moment to shift track. This hour, On Point, social critic Douglas Rushkoff on the unincorporated life. You can join the conversation. Is he right? Have you dreamed of another way? Is this the time for it, or is he dreaming? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now in the studio, and it's great to have him right here, is Douglas Rushkoff, writer, columnist, lecturer, professor of media studies at the New School University in New York, author of 10 books, including Get Back in the Box and Playing the Future and Coercion. His new book is called Life, Inc., How the World Became a Corporation and How to Take It Back. Douglas Rushkoff, it is wonderful to have you. Thank you very much
for being here. Great to be here.
We're going to talk about the route that you followed back and what you found back there, a kind of fork in the road. But let's just take it right to the moment. What's the evidence of a problem, apart from the crisis that we all know about, the economy as it has been is not doing well right now? But you're looking kind of through that and saying, we've got a bigger problem than that here, folks. What is it?
Well, you know, for me, it actually started right in the front stoop of my house. I was taking out the garbage on Christmas Eve a few years ago, and I got mugged at gunpoint. And, well, it's always traumatic to be mugged. I posted about this on a mailing list, a sort of a nice, lefty, crunchy community parents list online.
Because we should say your front step is not just Indians in Park Slope, Brooklyn. This is a kind of a gentrifying hipster
right.
part
a
of
gentrifying,
New York.
Yeah, a gentrifying parental
family.
You know, it's a part that was artists and lefties and lesbians and slowly became lawyers and bankers and other wealthy
folks.
Not the
place you think of being mugged at gunpoint on your doorstep.
Not generally, no. But so I posted where it happened and you know, that I was okay. Mm-hmm. And the first two emails I got back, and this is on Christmas Eve, were from people who were angry that I had posted the location where I was mugged because this could negatively affect their property value.
You're messing up the brand of our neighborhood.
Right. And I realized, I started to wonder what had happened to make people care more about the short-term asset value of their property than the long-term experiential value of their neighborhood.
Not to mention the short-term safety of their lives.
Right, right. That mattered less to them. And that was as good or a good an indicator as any that the real estate market was about to implode because it was no longer based
on brand.
Right.
And but you took it from there, from your doorstep, right on out into the world. Oh, open up the picture for us. When you started looking at everything as about, you know, what do you mean corporatized?
Well, I started to look back. I wanted to look at what value system had we internalized? How had we become almost like the worst corporations ourselves? In other words, the thing we always blame a Walmart for or an Exxon is that they don't really care about real places. They just care about their bottom line. Mm-hmm. And I realized here we were, as people walking around, caring more about our bottom line and our FICO score and our credit report than we were about the other people in our lives and having less and less time to consider alternatives. So I decided to look back sort of historically. This is what I do as I'm a media theorist, really, by trade. Mm-hmm. So could I look at money like a medium and sort of analyze money, which it is a medium. It's used for transaction between people, and look at what are the biases of this thing we call money?
I promise to go right back there in a half a nanosecond. But give us a few more examples first. You talk about how the world became a corporation. You talk about lives being corporatized. You found it around your neighborhood, your home, your very life. The brand mattered more than the immediate experience of those things.
Right.
What other evidence or examples of that might you point to help our listeners get tuned in to what you're talking about here before we go back to the Renaissance?
Oh, gosh. I mean, I became really aware of this sort of almost spiral that happens, this sort of unvirtuous circle as we make decisions. So I have a friend who lives in Minnesota named Jennifer, and she they changed her health plan, right, her HMO, whatever. Mm-hmm. So she had to stop buying her prescription from the druggist in her town that she'd been using for 15 or 20 years and start going to Walmart. You know, and she was sad about doing that, but it's what she could afford. That was it. He couldn't lower his prices because he had to pay rent and mortgage and God knows what else. And she couldn't afford the surcharge. But the problem was the druggist's wife goes to the same PTA meetings, Parent-Teacher Association meetings in town, that Jennifer goes to. So now Jennifer started to feel embarrassed to show up at those meetings because she was going to have to look in the face and the eyes of the woman whose husband she's no longer buying medication from. So now, because of one decision, she ends up making another decision and is further desocialized as a result. Now her PTA and her school no longer have her volunteering for it because she can't go and associate with those people who she feels that she's betraying.
In a way, she's sucked in an instant into a corporate reality and away from the community reality that is or would be or should be all around her.
You would think, right? Or I think about my own experience growing up. You know, when I was a kid, we lived in a middle-class neighborhood of Queens. And because we couldn't afford bigger, you know, everyone had tiny backyards. We had one barbecue pit at the end of the block. Mm. And every Friday night, the thing would get torched up. And parents would just send kids down with a couple of weenies and someone would cook them up. It was like this weekend-long block party barbecue.
Sounds pretty good.
Yeah, my dad got better jobs. Right. And as he got better jobs, we moved to better suburbs of New York and we ended up with a nice big backyard of our own and our own barbecue pit. You know, so now instead of barbecuing with the Joneses, we were sort of barbecuing against the Joneses. You know, they had T-bone, we had porterhouse, they had sirloin, we had filet mignon.
And each had your own pits, maybe with your own fence around them.
Right. And we all had our own barbecues. Mm-hmm. Now, measured in the GNP, this is good. You want every American family to have its own barbecue because if we're sharing a barbecue, then there's less barbecues being sold, less jobs for barbecue makers, less iron ore coming out of the ground. But the actual experience was gone. So as we did better, we actually started to experience less neighborliness, less comfort, less of what made life fun.
You're describing in these examples how this process cost you and others community. But you also say in the book, to get really big, it may cost us our souls. What do you mean?
Well, I don't know that I use the word soul.
Not exactly, but it's more than just community you're describing being lost here.
Right. What I'm talking about really is, and that's why it takes 500 years of history to describe it, is really the way we've become disconnected from place, disconnected from people, disconnected from value, that we use institutions, whether it's, you know, corporations or governments or movements or whatever we call it, we use very big institutions to serve as intermediaries between people. And as a result, we no longer feel capable of creating value for one another, of sharing, of gifting to one another. We're afraid to accept gifts from someone else, lest we be now obligated to them in some way we don't understand. You know, we ended up creating really a playing field that's tilted against people doing stuff for one another and enjoying one another and tilted towards people buying and spending, often in ways that don't actually make them happy.
And we take for granted that this is the way it has to be. You write in Life, Inc., I thought this was a great little paragraph. You say, you call this corporatism, and you say corporatism didn't evolve naturally. The landscape on which we are living, the operating system on which we are now running our social software, was invented by people, sold to us as a better way of life, supported by myths, and ultimately allowed to develop into a self-sustaining reality. It is a map that has replaced the territory. Wow, you put us in a kind of a false world. It feels like the real world.
Well, there are a lot of underlying assumptions about our world that we accept as given truths that are created truths. One is that the stuff in our pockets is money. It's not money. It's a kind of money. Another is that
when I pull it out, I can buy bread. The bread's real.
You can buy bread, and the corporation that you're buying bread from will accept that as tender right now. But it's only one of many different kinds of money we could have made, and it has certain kinds of rules, and it works with interest. It supports a certain kind of speculative economy, banking interest. It works really well for some things, but it has certain biases that we don't we're not generally aware of. Mm. We accept the premise that everybody's out for himself, that we live in a self-interested world, that human beings are in competition, that evolution is a story about people competing with other people, when actually that's not what evolution is at all, that the human species evolved because of food sharing and collaboration as much as it did its ability to compete with other species. You know, we believe that our society is doing better when the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up. We believe that the GNP and the GDP are proper metrics for whether or not a society is healthy, whereas an environmental disaster or a whole bunch of people getting cancer will make the GDP go up. You know,
great. As you describe it, though, I mean, the book says you're not anti-capitalist. It sounds anti-capitalist. It's so elemental to capitalism that everybody's out for themselves. I mean, isn't that like a first premise?
It's not, actually. I mean, read your Adam Smith, you mm-hmm. know, who's mm-hmm. the capitalist hero. Commerce is a great thing. It really is. And that's the thing. That's why I get confused when people call me a leftist, because I would think in some ways I probably these days have more in line with an extreme, a true fiscal conservative than I do with a leftist interventionist. But I believe that free markets should be able to work. What I found out, though, is that the thing we're calling the free market is not a free market at all, that the thing we're calling the free market was actually is a landscape that was created to allow corporations to interact with one another. But it's a landscape where it's very, very hard for people to actually run small businesses or create value for one another.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about life inside and outside the corporate world, the corporate mold, if you can imagine that, with deep social critic Douglas Rushkoff, talking about maybe the unincorporated life he describes. His new book is Life, Inc., How the World Became a Corporation and How to Take it Back. And Doug, just in the break, you were talking about yet another example of how what may have been utterly human can maybe become corporatized.
Well, yeah, I mean, I was thinking about my wife and I, our experience of conception and childbirth and child rearing. There were so many companies involved in
branded
in
birth.
First, oh my gosh! First in promoting our fertility and everything else. Mm-hmm. I mean, it ended up the old fashioned ways tended to work better than than what modern science
right
had
on.
To offer. And then you know we have our kid and we realize. Our moms can't teach us how to breastfeed because they were from the era of, you know, Similac and formula when we believed formula.
Wow, they're already uncoupled. Even the grandmothers are uncoupled from
exactly.
that.
Exactly. But you know, we ended up hiring, as everyone else in my neighborhood did, hiring a professional, you know, board certified lactation consultant to teach us.
Lactation consultant? I never heard of that.
To teach us, you know, latch and draw and all the various terms they have for. And, you know, there were plenty of old ladies in our building who had birthed enough and mm-hmm. breastfed enough babies, mm-hmm. you know, why didn't we just let one of them come over and they would have gladly showed us how this is done? It's because we're actually uncomfortable experiencing that level of intimacy with our friends and neighbors, or worst case, accepting a gift from a neighbor. If we let this 80-year-old woman show us how to breastfeed,
who knows what comes next? We might have to help her if she falls.
We might have to help her if she falls. What if she's in the hospital? What if she wants to come over and sing show tunes?
Yeah. And pretty soon, the most fundamental human interaction, breastfeeding, nursing, is corporatized or made into a cash transaction. You say, and I quote it again, the operating system on which we're now running our social software was invented by people. And you're right, its basic laws were set in motion as far back as the Renaissance. Take us back. What was there? How do you interpret history and what happened here? This seems so natural where we are now. I mean, in the sense of inevitable, you say it. Maybe it wasn't.
Right. I mean, there have been a few moments in history when people have been doing well or having lots of commerce or having lots of feast and some kind of central authority has come in and try to profit off it, whether it was, you know, back in ancient Egypt when the pharaoh developed his indentured servitude system, mm-hmm. or whether it was in Rome.
Tote that boulder and build that obelisk.
Right. Mm-hmm. 7 years of feast and 7 years of famine. Mm-hmm. You know, he made mm-hmm. the storehouses, and then if you wanted some of that grain, you'd have to go into debt. Mm-hmm. Or later, you know, the Roman Empire, every time it went to a place it needed to take over, it outlawed the local currency and made everyone use Roman coin and till they spread a little bit too far. Mm-hmm. And then in our era, it really is the Renaissance. I look back to see when were the innovations in finance and banking and corporatism really, really launched, and it was in the Renaissance. And what I found out was that, you know, at the very end of the Middle Ages, I know we all think of the Middle Ages as these dark ages with plague and horror mm-hmm. and terrible stuff.
Yes, we do.
But the fact is, the plague didn't take place during the Middle Ages. The plague actually took place at the beginning of the Renaissance. The late Middle Ages, 10th through 13th century Western European history, was probably the most prosperous set of centuries in human history. Our population was increasing. People worked 4 days a week at most. They had four meals a day. Women were taller in late Middle Ages England than they are today. Men were taller than at any time since until like about the 1970s, and that's because of hormones in our milk.
Who knew?
They had another 70 days off. Really, the middle class was right. There was a merchant middle class. People were trading with other regions, and they were doing quite, quite well. The problem is the aristocracy, the people who had been the feudal lords mm-hmm. and were now sort of the fledgling proto-kings, they weren't getting rich. They were getting relatively poor. So people who had spent 4 or 5 centuries basically getting to be rich by being rich. In other words,
by being feudal lords, by having the castle and the armor and the horse.
People that had been rich by birth mm-hmm. were losing that ability and losing their wealth.
So,
and they needed to come up with a way to make money simply by having money.
Now, they were losing the relative wealth because the folks outside the castle walls were engaging in commerce and building their own standard of living.
Right. They were interacting directly. They were mm-hmm. using, and we can talk about it later, they were actually using local currencies. They were mm-hmm. using currencies that were based on the amount of grain that they had brought to the grain store.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, so this was actually a different kind of a currency system that was based in abundance. There was as much money, really, as there was prosperity. People were doing so well in the late Middle Ages. They had so much extra money to invest that they mm-hmm. built the cathedrals. We mm-hmm. call the late Middle Ages the age of the cathedrals. And this wasn't because the Vatican was cutting a check to Chartres somewhere to build mm-hmm. a cathedral. It was because they needed a way to invest their money in the future, to get pilgrims and tourists for future generations.
And we still flock to those as great examples of
they
human
were great
creativity and aspiration.
Right.
Even
now,
unto the heavens. But the aristocrat looks out and says, hey, I'm losing my edge here.
I am losing my edge. I am landlocked. I don't have a way to create value.
Mm-hmm.
So how can I still maintain my wealth when I don't work, when I don't create value?
Mm-hmm.
They came up with two ideas. One was the chartered corporation.
Mm-hmm.
What the king did, it's really the chartered monopoly corporation. What the king did was went to the wealthiest merchants and said, do you want to not have to worry about competition anymore? How about I grant you a total monopoly of your industrial sector. So you are the only one who's allowed to make this product. You are the only one who's allowed to colonize the West Indies. You're the only one who's allowed to bring back gold from Africa.
And I'll protect that right with my sword and shield.
With my sword and shield and this piece of law, this contract.
Mm-hmm.
All I want is, say, 15%?
Uh-huh.
18%?
Well, let's 20? Use our old-time power, horse, sword, lance, shield, to grab a piece of this commerce and make it our own.
And an eroding power. I mean, I don't know how much longer they would have even had the ability to write laws. But while they still had it, while they still had that power, they wrote laws that then said, okay, British East India Company, you are allowed to go to America and you are the only company that's allowed to buy cotton. So an American colonist now, if you're growing cotton, you cannot sell it to your friends. You can't make clothes out of it. You've got to sell it to the British East India Company at the prices we establish. They're going to ship it back to England, where another one of my chartered monopolies is going to fabricate it into clothes. Then we're going to ship it back to you, and then you buy it at the prices we establish.
Are you sure you got this right? I mean, maybe it just wouldn't have happened without this kind of organized effort of that chartered corporation. I mean, starting the East India Company or the West India Company, those are big undertakings. Were a bunch of guys who grew rye or oats in central England going to do that? Was it going to happen without that kind of organization?
Well, it did happen.
Maybe we would have just stayed home.
The fact is, more food was being produced on the fields in the late Middle Ages than after those fields were cordoned off, and people were no longer allowed to use what were called the common lands. They couldn't graze their sheep.
Right, but were those individual farmers putting together expeditions to the East Indies?
And taking over and killing thousands of people in those places?
So
no.
Colonialism right along with
colonialism
your
model. Colonialism was an accelerated, and I would argue artificially accelerated, quest for resource exploitation that didn't happen in the most human-centered, natural, commercial way. And it was done in such a way that if the colonists in one of those region or the natives in that region started to create an industry that supported the corporation, the corporation would put them out of business. So that if you go to the West Indies and you need a lot of rope for the stuff you're doing, so people, the natives there go, oh, let's make rope for the British East India Trading Company and sell it to them. All of a sudden, British East India Company says, oh, no, you're not allowed to make rope anymore. You have to use the British East India Rope Company. And there'd be a rebellion and people would be bloodshed because people wanted the right to create value, but they weren't allowed to. They were only allowed to do it as employees of the corporation.
Famously, centuries later, with Gandhi and salt at the beaches in India, an act of defiance simply to go lift up the salt. But you're assuming that this might have gone a different way.
Well,
all
it
those
was
folks
going
with their swords
way.
And shields would have stayed in their castle until they fell down and they just became one more farmer on the block. That's not exactly the way of human history. People with power do tend to find ways to extend it.
They do, and it went this way. But now that it's gone this way for 400 years and it's been – and we could talk about the other centuries and it's been sold to us as a better way of life. And every time we – well, by in the last main effort of the public relations industry, really from the 30s to the 70s, we were convinced that corporations really are our great heroes. We have more faith in brands than we do in each other. Mm-hmm. We'd rather buy oats with a Quaker on them than oats from Joe around the corner who might – put them in his mill. We want to buy our toys from Mattel and Disney, even though they were outsourced to China and ended up with lead in them. Then we're willing to buy toys from the handcrafted toy alliance of people in America, you know, little toy manufacturers. And we've that's crashed. I mean, the other big innovation that we kind of have to go back to in the Renaissance, in addition to the chartered corporation, was centralized currency. So now, instead of people being able to create currency on their own in all their own little towns, those currencies were actually made illegal, and people had to use what was called coin of the realm.
Mm-hmm, right.
And that's, you know—
And then you're in the system.
And then you're in the system. And those were scarce currencies. Once you're using a scarce currency, in other words, one that is meted out by a central authority rather than one that is earned into existence by farmers, now all of a sudden competition is part of business rather than and it's the operating system for business. And if you look at how that's trickled down to us today as central banking, how do we get money? We lend money into existence. The Fed lends it at an interest rate to a bank that lends it at another interest rate that lends it at another. That more money than is lent out has to be paid back. And how does that get paid back? More money is put out.
Douglas Rushkoff is about as ambitious as you can be at looking at all this right now. And most times Americans don't really think about this too much. But right now we've got an economic crash. Some people talking about an environmental crash. We'll talk about how it might have been, how it might yet be. But we have a lot of listeners who want to get in on this with you, Doug Rushkoff. Sudhia is calling from Boston. Hi, Sudhia. You're on the air.
Hi, yes. I'm Dave.
Oh, hi. Welcome. You're on.
Oh, I'm a management trainer, and we train the managements and about corporate managements all over the world.
Yes.
Basically, we are located in India, Hyderabad. And I worked in the corporations and banks, and I'm a professor. I wrote a book.
So you're an enabler of the corporate world. Do you think it's working? Is it not working? Or what do you think of Douglas Rushkoff's argument?
Oh, I support his argument. And
wait a minute. You're training these corporations, but you support his argument? Why?
No, I train for skills improvement and to help the community, not for a profit. I'm not for a profit motive. My training is for a value system and to benefit skills to help the employees to help the community. So it's not for money. I'm training.
Got it. Management, but not for money. Well,
that's a hard job, but God bless him for going for it. I mean, I spent some time trying to do advising in the corporate world, and the main thing I ended up telling corporations was that they should try to find and hire people who have skills in the industry that the corporation is in. It sounds insane,
yes.
But most corporations today, they no longer do the thing they do. They outsource so much, and they just manage a balance sheet.
Sit at the middle, right?
So that I found that one of the easiest ways to get corporations behaving, even to begin behaving ethically, is rather than just teaching them about ethics, which is a great thing, is to actually get them to care about the industry they're in. So if they're a bike manufacturer, you know, what if you had the CEO of a bike company being someone who really cared about bikes?
Mm-hmm.
Then he's going to want to make good bikes because that's part of what, you know, part of what he cares about. It's just, can he make good bikes and answer the needs of his shareholders at the same time?
Let's go to David in Hampstead, New Hampshire. David, you're on the air with Douglas Rushkoff.
Well, thank you so much. I don't call into talk shows.
But so, here you are.
here I am, but somebody actually remembers Adam Smith and knows it wasn't an author in the 80s who wrote some interesting books.
Mm-hmm.
I was trained as an economist originally, and though I now work in human services, did a banking stint in the way, and they call me Reverend Doctor, all of which I have to keep separate, and let me tell you, it's a crazy world. But I didn't hear once the name Adam Smith the entire time I was being educated in economics. I had to read The Wealth of Nations on my own, and I could spend hours talking with you. I'm so glad somebody's actually bringing the subject up. I'm going to buy your book. But you know, Adam Smith was so grounded, and I know the idea may no longer be conceptually valid, but in the idea of the Christian gentleman, if you will, he presumed, as Marx did in his own way, that there was going to be some sort of goodwill underpinning to the behavior of individuals. That was going to ground capitalism as he saw it. And then, of course, we eventually had this shift into monopolization, laissez-faire capitalism, which never gets discussed. The two seem to get lumped together consistently whenever capitalism is being talked about. And that, of course, wasn't the concept of Adam Smith at all. I guess I'm wondering to what extent you feel laissez-faire capitalism, or when it hijacked Adam Smith's original thinking. And I guess I want my own mind to be clear that while you are not necessarily anti-capitalist, and while you wouldn't define yourself as left, and I think that's a really complicated term that one shouldn't try to pin down too much, you almost sound communalist as versus those other two things. And I guess I'd like a little more clarity where you stand on that. But I'm really, really curious as to where you feel kind of the split into what became laissez-faire capitalism and corporatism came.
David, our time is very short before the break. Let's get half of that. Let's start with Adam Smith and the hijack. Do you see a hijacking of a capitalism?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was actually, it happened in America around the time of Lincoln. And it's when Lincoln actually argued for the railroad corporations to promote the rights of those corporations, the railroad corporations, to manage the land that their rails traveled through rather than municipalities. And that was really, I think, in America, the main moment that corporations ended up having will over what I'd have to call the communities and municipalities. The people who actually lived in those places had less control over what happened in them than the trains that were passing through.
If he hadn't done that, could we have railroads? Railroads have to pass through a lot of communities. Anyone could block the way nearly or make it uneconomic to have a railroad. Is that what you're arguing for?
I'm arguing for states to have, or states that could have had some leverage in the way their territory was bisected by trains. You know, rather than passing through where they didn't want them, they could decide. Yeah, so it might have to take a little curve here in order to protect this town of people who've been here for 100 years.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about life inside and outside the corporate mold with social critic Douglas Rushkoff. He's looking to champion the unincorporated life, says we could have gone that way, but we didn't. Douglas Rushkoff's new book is Life, Inc. Let's get a call from Chicago. Dave, you're on the air with Douglas Rushkoff.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well. What do you see?
Good. Well, this goes back to a comment that your guest made earlier when I just started my drive into Chicago in the rain and about the barbecue pits. And it has to do with my wife, who contends she grew up in a small Indiana town. And every night in the summer and the spring, the families would go out on their porches and the kids would play in the streets.
Mm-hmm.
The parents would talk to one another and there would be community interaction. And then with the introduction of the window air.
You there, Dave?
He's talking about
the window air conditioner. Of course. And you're suddenly you're in the house, you're off the porch, it all goes away.
Right. And it's funny, I was just talking to the guy, what's the guy that, he's in New York and he decided he was going to live just and have no impact on the, No Impact Man, have you heard about him?
No.
It's a guy, No Impact Man, and he decided to live for a year with his family and have no impact on the environment,
okay.
Living in New York City.
Okay.
And he took all the air conditioner out. He brought his TV back after the year was up, but he left the air conditioner out because he found that without the air conditioner, it forced his family to go outside at night, and they were going to the fountain in Washington Square Park and meeting other people. So, right, certain things that we have, I mean, it's not that we have to get rid of our air conditioners. It's that we have to then remember, what are we leaving behind, you know, and making a choice on whether to use it.
That seems completely to get out of the economic realm and into a kind of lifestyle or religion, I don't know what. I mean, nobody forced people to put window air conditioners or central air conditioners in their house. The question that this brings in the back of my mind is, I mean, you're talking here about it might be a better way, but the way we have wasn't entirely imposed by, you know, middle guys out of the Renaissance with swords and shields.
You write about the
spirit of progress and personal freedom. Those have been celebrated throughout the same period that corporatism has flourished. And I don't know if corporations churning out air conditioners are what people wanted.
No, well, it's actually compensating for the fact that we're living in separate cubicles. I mean, really, the American way of life, what we understand now as the suburbs and our separate nuclear family way of living, was really invented for us at the end of World War II by FDR and the Leavitt brothers. And FDR and Leavitt brothers, who built Leavittown, actually worked together on social planning. What kind of house should we make? FDR wanted a house that celebrated the values of the nuclear family over the community. He didn't want places where men are going to congregate and get in trouble, where people are going to, you know, he didn't want union halls. He didn't want big places.
FDR didn't want union halls?
No, he did not. He wanted nuclear families in separate houses. He wanted the men to be taken up with gardening the house. He wanted people to have, on the one hand, it was great, mortgages. But on the other hand, when you have a mortgage, you're going to support the bank. You're going to support the system.
So wait a minute. Leavittown was created
consciously. And all the documentation is there. The letters back and forth from FDR to the Leavitt brothers on how do we keep families occupied and happy and how do we promote the values of the nuclear family over those of community in general.
But this goes back to our earlier caller's question for you. Are you, Douglas Rushkoff, then, really a capitalist of just a different stripe or a kind of communalist who's looking for community dynamics to trump economics?
I'm looking for us to rebuild the mechanisms through which people exchange value with one another, both commercially and communally, whether it's creating gift networks, babysitting clubs, working for one another, mowing each other's lawns, bringing meals to people, doing stuff that you want to do, or trading directly, being able to compete effectively against large corporations that get their money cheaper, that get their land cheaper, that get their labor cheaper, and that at every turn of the way end up getting regulations that promote their interests over local farmers, over local shoemakers, over local druggists, over local, really, small businesses everywhere.
Peabody, Massachusetts. Jeff, you're on the air with Douglas Rushkoff.
Hi, that's a great time to jump in. I've got an issue. We've heard a lot of facts, but I really think that he's stretching the point on causation a lot. But I'd like to focus on the simplest point. What a corporation does is it allows investment in some sort of opportunity, and the people that are investing in it, basically all they're putting at risk is their money. And therefore, it's actually freeing of small people. So if you're a small-time, educated, hardworking person, and you've got a great idea for a bike shop or something else, but you don't have the wherewithal to put that idea into action, mm-hmm. you can form a corporation, a small business, mm-hmm. incorporate, and then go out and get investors to back you. And they may just back you a little bit, and then you go to a bank with that backing and get a little more capital. But that's how businesses get started. Mm-hmm. That's how ideas grow. That's how jobs come into being.
That's how transcontinental railroads got built. I mean, are you saying, Douglas, first of all, do you agree? And if you, I don't know, do we have to be small if we don't go the corporate way? Corporations are the banding together of resources. That much is true. That's made a lot of things possible in this world.
Yeah. And that's definitely true. But the bias of larger corporations is really towards their original monopolistic programming. You know, when Walmart opens up two stores in an area with the intent of closing one after they've put everyone else out of business and just forcing people to drive further, that's the sort of slash and burn monopolist corporate activity I'm talking about. Mm. I do believe I incorporated. I formed an S corporation, you know, and my wife and I are the employees. And although we didn't look for investors, there's certain, you know, tax advantages and structural advantages. And now I can, you know, hire other people and researchers.
Yeah, but you're a hopeless capitalist. You hired a lactation nanny.
Yeah, really. I know. I'm already on the wrong side of the equation. But no, so I do agree that certain aspects of the corporate model really do work, and getting people to invest in what you're doing is great. But the way we invest in corporations, most of us, is at a great, great distance. There are companies in my 401k plan that I don't know what they do, and all I want is for their quarterly report to go up so the share price goes up. And when you invest at such a great distance, really the right hand doesn't know what the left hand is doing.
Let me ask an impish these great projects that corporations make possible, even if you don't know what the left is making the right doing. You know, the East India Company left, you know, the British in charge of South Asia. I mean, the jungle of the world is at work here at some level. And the countries that got powerful anyway had these corporations that built great big things, ships and railroads, and became imperial powers. You may not like that, but they dominated
did.
And continue in many ways to dominate the world even now. I mean,
the
community may pick this up, but if a country picks this up, is it going to get rolled over by somebody else who goes corporate, gets big, and, you know, goes imperial?
I mean, when I was in junior high school, there were bullies who really did – they own the halls, you know, and they can grab any one of us and give us a noogie and push us down. And then we grew up, and the worst of them are in jail, and the rest of them have grown up. It is true that at a certain stage of Western civilization, you know, and you can read Guns, Germs, and Steel for this, mm-hmm. you know, the people with the most aggressive economic posture also had the best gunpowder. And got a lot done. But as Obama admits now, the ability of capitalism to spread into new territories, our ability to grow by colonizing Africa or South America is reaching a certain kind of pushback now. Mm-hmm. We can't really colonize new regions the same way we did before. We've really reached the limits of exerting global power in this way.
That's pretty clear.
And if we do, then maybe the most aggressive corporatist postures that we've taken, our you know, tactic of colonizing and monopolizing, may have reached a point of diminishing returns, at which point we have to start looking towards more sustainable bottom-up economic mechanisms rather than just coercive top-down ones.
Douglas Rushkoff may be the pragmatist. Robert in Burlington, Vermont, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
At the beginning of the show, you said something about if the time now was just right for Rushkoff's ideas, and I'm saying that it has always been right. We knew it back in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s with the rat race imagery, and the greed is good culture, which led to just an unsustainable lifestyle where a chicken in every pot became four cars in every McMansion. Completely unsustainable. And what has happened is it has caused the perversion of what a developed society should be. And a small example that I always refer to being an electrical engineer is the perversion of the promise of technology. Do you remember back in the when we were kids, you know, how technology was supposed to make our life better and increase our lifestyle, give us more of time for creativity? And look at, like, say, the PC in the 70s and the 80s. They were supposed to save us work and save paper in the office.
Mm-hmm.
And what has happened as a result? It's only gotten worse. And it's because of greed. Instead of trying to save us work, they tried to increase profits as a consequence of a technological benefit.
Right, exactly. And what I'm trying to do with this book is to take it out of the context of greed, because I think most of the people who are perpetuating this system are not actually greedy people. I think they're living on a landscape where greed is sort of the operating principle, that when you have a speculative economy that is bigger than your real economy, the needs of companies to grow really outweighs whatever supply and demand principle that Adam Smith might have talked about before, that corporations are really the victims of their debt structures now. So that if you create a technology that makes something more efficient, that is a problem. You know, that's actually a bad thing in the current economic landscape rather than a good thing.
Let's go to Montreal, Canada. And Doug. Doug, you're on the air with Douglas Rushkoff.
Oh, hi. This is Doug, another Doug. I'm just calling to make the point that essentially we live in the most open, fair, and gender-neutral, race-neutral, and economically neutral society in the history of mankind. It's all underpinned by capitalism and under the ideas of Adam Smith and others. The idea that somehow this should be replaced and that we should eliminate money as a medium of exchange, which is inherently fair, there's no real dichotomy between corporations and me. I can start a corporation the moment I want, and my creativity is really unlimited in this society, as is my opportunity. I really question the whole notion and the underpinnings of this argument.
We're free. Capitalism made us so.
What's interesting, though, is that what he hears is that I said we should eliminate money as a means of exchange. That there's an extremism underpinning our thinking about the economy, that it's either boom or crash. That when I say I think we need to develop some other mechanisms for exchange, whether learning how to do gifts for people, you know, letting an old lady teach my wife how to breastfeed is suddenly equated with getting rid of money.
You're free to,
and I'm not talking
taken,
about that.
But you are free to do that right now. Doug in Montreal says, look, we're free.
Right.
We could be doing this, but we're not. And we've got a lot of freedom. And we've got, you know.
But we're not. And I would argue, yes, we have a certain amount of freedom. But I think most of the people listening to this broadcast know what it's like to work 5 or 6 days a week and take that extra day that you would much rather be doing something meaningful or growing some of your own food or taking your kids to a farm. And you run to the Costco or you run to the fast food place. And no value against McDonald's, but the whole notion of fast food, why do we have to eat quickly and spend so much time working? It's in order to support what I've come to call almost an insulation equation. We are all free to earn enough money to insulate ourselves from the world we live in, rather than spending our time and energy actually making the world a place that we want to live in.
So paint the Rushkoff picture then. What would it look like if we did it your way? And how might we get there?
I think it's gonna take micro decisions. You know, I don't believe in joining big movements and raising our fists. And you know,
even though it's big time law that now buttresses the corporation, you think micro decisions?
It is. Well, micro decisions make the difference, because once you make a micro decision, you butt up against big law soon enough. So a friend of mine in Brooklyn wanted to make his street quieter because people were honking just all the time, and he ended up becoming the head of a group called, you know, Traffic Alternatives and Streets Blog. He ended up learning about how does traffic work? How do we build bike lanes? How do we promote the safety of bike people? How do we deal with the oil industry? And now he's one of the main people involved in changing the way roads work in Brooklyn, New York. I know organic farmers in upstate New York whose land, for no good reason other than bizarre lobbying, they're not allowed to grow chard on their land, which is what they want to grow. Their land is set aside for corn.
Okay.
By the corn industry, which you wouldn't grow corn there anyway. It's not because of a lobby and a thing and a set aside, and it's just another thing. So now they've got to go. I know people in Iowa who are trying to create a small cottage industry to build solar panels for people's houses, but the way things are legislated there, you're not allowed to do. You're not allowed to combine your own power with, you know, the electric utility power because of the payback system and all that. So you end up running up against those things.
So but you think it's real? We've got 2 minutes. You think it's really happening in spite of the existing corporate power structure? This is happening anyway through all these micro
decisions? Oh, I think it's happening now because the banks and lots of corporations are in paralysis. And the longer they're in paralysis, the more people you have, real people who have time and who have needs and are willing to provide those for one another. I mean, I look at in Japan during the big recession there, people couldn't get health care for their elders. Mm. So what they ended up doing was creating a elder care dollar system, an alternative currency, where hundreds of millions of dollars of health care were provided. You take care of some old person in your town, you'd get credits in the system, and someone else would take care of your old person in their town.
You watch my mom, they'll watch your aunt. And
right. And it was all taken care of. Not yet, you have to get rid of the yen, but if the yen or dollars are not available, if you can't get the loan, but you've got the time and you've got the skills, you can begin providing them through other networks.
Free at last. You might say, when? When? Right now it's happening?
It's happening
if,
right
if
now.
If you come back in 50 years, you think it's going to be the uncorporate world?
No, I don't. I actually, my actual belief is that we will pave over this financial crisis in the next year or so and make people believe that everything really is okay, that the underpinnings of our economy are strong, that a speculation-based economy really can work, and then 4 or 5 years from now, there'll be true hell to pay.
Well, here was a cry from the heart along the way that takes us right back to the Renaissance and maybe forward somewhere interesting as well. If not this year, maybe some year. Douglas Rushkoff, it is always it's always a pleasure to talk to you. It's always a trip. And the new book is Life, Inc., How the World Became a Corporation and How to Take It Back. We'll have you back one day to ask how you think President Obama is doing in these terms, in your terms. Thank you so much for coming to see us
Thanks
today.
For doing the show.
Douglas Rushkoff, thanks for being here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Listeners, thanks for joining us.